We're exploring crucial metrics to better understand the spread of the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You may keep tabs on dashboards to monitor the virus outbreak at the state, national, international level. Johns Hopkins University is one go-to place pooling multiple sources of information. At the state level, we have the Department of Health Services presenting daily metrics. The Wisconsin Hospital Association runs a dashboard, but different trackers crunch numbers in different ways. There isn't a consistent tracking method across the U.S., nor the world for that matter. So one thing we do know, no country knows the total number of people who are infected with COVID-19. What do you want to know about dashboards and metrics and how to interpret so many numbers? It's 800-642-1234. Join in. Liberty Vittert is professor of the practice of data science at the Olin Business School at Washington University in St. Louis. Liberty, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Well, give us the worldview first, if you will. How does the U.S. compare to other countries in the COVID metrics that we publish and the data we use to track the spread of the virus?
You know, one of the hard things about comparing countries is that there's so many different ways that countries choose to collect this data. And there are also so many different levels of privacy within different countries. There are different ways that they are measuring who's being tested, what a death is recorded as. It's, you know, you see article after article where you're comparing the U.S. to South Korea or to Germany or to Russia. And it's sort of a tiny bit disingenuous accidentally to do so, because we do not have a standard way of comparing the United States to all other countries.
Well, you mentioned South Korea there, which, has received a lot of attention in how it has curbed COVID cases. Can you tell us how data is used and published in South Korea?
Yeah, South Korea has done an incredible job at contract tracing. So one of the biggest ways is, you know, you go to work, you go to the grocery store, you go all the places that you go in your normal life. And the question is, if you get sick, where did it happen? What was the origin of the disease for you? And it sounds like it'd be really, really hard to contact trace and to figure out whether you got it from the grocery store, from the gym, or from your Aunt Matilda. But with the world of contact tracing, which means people can look at your cell phone, they can track exactly where you are, they can look at the contacts in your cell phone, text messages you would have had, social media that you would have been participating in, it's actually quite easy to figure out where you went and who you were with and who those people that you were with, meaning that there's an ability to figure out really precisely who you got this disease from and who else they infected. And that is one thing that South Korea has been incredible at doing.
So smartphone and apps here taking a very much a lead role in being able to contact trace. And in the U.S., it involves long phone calls and trying to go through or allowing the person to go through their own memory and their maybe even their own cell phone to figure out where they've been.
Exactly. You know, there's a couple sort of main issues that we have in the U.S. that make our ability to track this data very difficult. The first is the fact that we are decentralized. So every state is responsible for doing this, and they are doing it in very different ways, as there is not sort of a standard metric that is being used. That pesky 10th Amendment in there. But one of the other sort of major issues with collecting this data in the U.S. versus many other countries is our belief in privacy. So, you know, do we want our phones to be tracked? Do we want do we want these government bodies to have access to every single thing we do? Officially, it's called geolocation tracking. So it takes your cell phone and authorities track your movements over these weeks, and they can look at your texts and your social media accounts and who knows what else. And there have been some people in Congress who've said it's okay for the U.S. to use these data surveillance options, as long as there's, you know, certain procedures to keep the data safe. But, you know, usually I'm a pretty trusting person, but that's a whole lot of faith that you are putting in the government and major tech companies to take not just your own private information, but your families and your friends. And as we know, there have been multiple times where data has been used inappropriately by government and by private organizations. In Israel, this emergency regulations are already allowed. Russia, they're using facial recognition technology to make sure infected individuals don't leave their homes or hotels, and China as well. So, there's a question for the American public of where's the trade-off with what we are comfortable with privacy-wise and the horrible tragedy that is affecting our country with people dying of coronavirus.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Liberty Vittert, who is a professor of the practice of data science at Washington University in St. Louis. We're exploring what's behind the dashboards, the metrics, the privacy issues, how states and countries track COVID. With your questions, do you trust the U.S.'s data tracking and the systems in place at the state level? What will you think about as the virus spreads? What numbers do you keep an eye on? How do you want to see lawmakers step up to fix the U.S.'s data tracking problem? Join in at 800-642-1234. Liberty, last year, a group of epidemiologists, they wrote a report that described our system for gathering and sharing public health data as slow and antiquated. What are your thoughts on how the U.S.'s public health system operates in the background?
One of the major issues that the U.S. has with tracking this data is our lack of a centralized healthcare system. So you take something like the U.K., who has the national healthcare system, the NHS. It's a whole lot easier to track when it's all individual satellite national healthcare service offices reporting COVID data to you, rather than hospitals, urgent cares, testing sites, different healthcare providers. One of the things that gives us the best healthcare in the world, which is our healthcare system, also makes it very difficult to aggregate data, and especially to aggregate anonymized data. That's one of the big, sort of selling points, if you will, of the tech companies' efforts in terms of showing heat maps. Facebook put out these fabulous looking heat maps to show you where you would be at risk. And the idea was that your data would be completely anonymized. But the problem is it's not. And New York Times even did a study to show that this aggregated anonymized data of millions of people is actually very easy to track back to one person. So, in terms of our healthcare system, they are trying their very best to truly make it anonymous, which makes it very difficult to publish.
And I understand too that it's really low tech out there. Some operations still using fax machines.
Many operations, I think, are actually required to use fax machines, which is beyond, I don't even think I know how to fax anything anymore.
Printed side
And
goes
people,
down, Liberty. That's all you need to know.
exactly. My mother said that to me often. And you also you have personal stories. I always say that, even though we want to look at the big picture, you have personal stories. I tried to get a test. I trust had to fax in a note from my doctor to some testing center. They then, gave me a test date 2 weeks later, and then I didn't get the results back for 10 days, at which point I might as well have just quarantined for 4 weeks. So, the problem is we just do not have a standard with the way that we are collecting this data, with exactly what data we're taking. Some doctors, some are asked to ask where the person works, some aren't. A lot of people don't want to say where they work because they have a fear that they're going to lose their job if their temperature's too high. So, that we have no sort of standard system across the US to do this.
Washington University in St. Louis statistician Liberty Vittert is our guide to these data sets, COVID metrics that we're watching around the state, country, and world, learning about tracking, tracing, and counting COVID cases, taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about COVID-19 data sets and how U.S. states and countries report data in different ways, using different definitions when it comes to tracking the spread and the outcomes. Do you trust the U.S.'s data on COVID-19 numbers? How do you track the severity in our country and in your own community? What numbers don't make sense to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. Liberty Vittert is our guide. She's a professor of the practice of data science at Washington University in St. Louis. Liberty, there are a number of dashboards out there tracking COVID, as you mentioned, in so many different ways. But for people who aren't mathematicians, it's hard to really understand what all these numbers mean and which numbers we should pay most attention to. Can you give us any pointers?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it is very confusing, even for me, when you see all these numbers and you see different numbers. You see one tracker saying one thing, one another thing. But what I really look at is the rate, you know, the absolute number of how many people have the virus or how many people are being tested is not actually what matters as much as the rate at which this is happening. So if all of a sudden there's this enormous increase in one state or one county in the amount of people getting the virus, the rate from which you are increasing, if that starts to get big, then you should start to get worse.
So if you would see a
the same
a
idea
rate,
has to do with testing.
If you would see like a rate increase from 3% to 10% or a jump such as that, you might be very concerned.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of 5 people a day getting the virus, if you see 20 people a day getting the virus. So that would be the rate of change. How fast are people getting sick? That has to do with what the virus is. If you remember at the very beginning, the flatten the curve was the sort of the statement to go into lockdown. And that's because this virus, instead, you know, if I have the virus, I infect more than just one person. It can increase exponentially would be the fancy word to use. But really what that means is that instead of 5 people a day getting infected, 20 people a day are getting infected. And that adds on as you go further in the days.
What other things are you watching for in these dashboards? And certainly Johns Hopkins University has really been a leader on numbers and even journalists citing Johns Hopkins data. But, you know, as again, it can be really difficult to know what to pay attention to.
One of the, you know, it's not the most helpful thing, but one of the beliefs and sort of tenets of statistics and of data is uncertainty. So if one of these dashboards is telling you that I know this exact number, 1,132 people have coronavirus in this county or this state, that's not accurate. We know that we don't know. We know what we don't know, which is exactly how many people have this disease. And so what's really important and what sort of makes me trust different data organizations is when they tell you that there is uncertainty in this number, that it is there is a margin of error, there is a plus or minus. And it means, you know, it's a sign to me that they are really thinking through their numbers rather than just reporting a baseline.
And what happens when, a health department goes back and corrects numbers from previous days? Do you try to, is fine-tuning the data a good thing?
You know, that's a really good question. There's a lot of debate about that. The idea is to do the best you can. And the best you can means saying, you know, we were confused about this or we didn't know what this was. If there are big changes, then it can be very important. When there, you know, there's a limited amount of time in the day if you really want to get down to brass tacks. And the decision about how much time to spend going back and correcting very small numbers versus looking forward is always a question. You know, you could work till the day is done, but at some point you need to move on to something else. What can happen, though, is these small discrepancies can be magnified if they are not corrected. So a lot of it is a decision about what to work on in the past and what really needs to be worked on in the future.
We're talking with Liberty Vittert, who is a professor of the practice of data science at Washington University in St. Louis. We're talking about the metrics, the dashboards that help track the spread of the virus and what these numbers and data sets mean. You can join in with your questions about COVID data at 800-642-1234. Liberty, the CDC doesn't require those reporting COVID cases to include information about where people might have been infected, and the Department of Health and Human Services doesn't provide information on where outbreaks are located. What does it mean that this data is not there when it comes to public health decisions?
You know, it is a tricky question, because this goes back to our privacy rights. So if as we said, you know, this data, which is said to be anonymized, it's very easy to figure out who an individual is. And so if we're reporting where someone got infected, it starts to affect your privacy. And so it also means that we're not doing as good of a job as other countries who are choosing to report all of that information. Countries who are doing geolocation tracking are doing a significantly better job of controlling the virus. However, a significant amount of privacy rights by their electorate is being given up. So the question is, at what point is the United States and the public of the United States not going to be comfortable with the privacy regulations? Or at what point are they going to say this disease and this virus is scary enough and enough of a tragedy that we are willing to give up some of our rights in order to control it? With the ability to have contact tracing, we will be able to control the virus much, much more and much, much better. But there is a significant question of what we are willing to give up as Americans and our personal liberty and privacy.
Last summer, the White House ordered hospitals to send all their COVID data to the Department of Health and Human Services, bypassing the CDC. And this decision has been criticized for potentially decreasing data transparency and visibility and the seamlessness as hospitals try to upload this data. What do you see going on there?
You know, the CDC was being very slow in how they were reporting data. And so the Department of Health and Human Services felt that they could do a better job with a new type of system. Were they able to do a better job? No, that's probably the problem here. But, you know, to say that it affected data transparency is really not fair. You know, they had more money to put at the problem. They had a better data collection process than the CDC did have. The CDC has full access. Enormous amounts of CDC employees have access directly to the data. And this, you know, there was a lot of fear about data manipulation. But, you know, these are career scientists. These are career epidemiologists working at HHS with this data. There is no political, you know, manipulation within this data. The idea, you know, the real problem is that we weren't prepared in the first place. So to change the game halfway through the battle was a mistake. You know, and then, you know, hospitals get confused. Am I reporting to CDC? Do I report to the Department of Health and Human Services? Do I depart to my state? Who do I report to? It's more an issue of changing the game during the fight than anything else.
Let's take a call now. David is joining us from Platteville. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. I have an observation and a question for your guest. My observation is every day on our local radio station issues a report that says, for example, in the county there were 120 cases of coronavirus, and then later on in the report they'll say 114 have recovered. That's meaningless to me as someone who's trying to decide how much I can be out or not out in the public, rather than just reporting how many active cases there are on a daily basis. That's my observation. My question for your guest is, you know, the statistic, and this is for a layperson to understand, when they say, for example, we've conducted 40 million tests, does that mean 40 million people have been tested? Because I know, for example, I've been tested multiple times. Or does that mean a smaller number of people have been tested, but in total, that equates to 40 million tests, mm-hmm. whether you had one test or 20 tests.
And David, thanks. Yeah. We're short on time. Liberty, go ahead.
David, that's an excellent question. I can tell you it does not mean 40 million people have been tested. You are absolutely right. Your numbers are included in there for your multiple tests. And there's no telling whether some of those tests are at-home tests, whether they're the nose swab, whether they're the throat swab. Some people have been tested 50 times. So you are absolutely correct in thinking that that is not 40 million people, individuals who have all been tested.
And in the last few seconds here, he's criticizing just, how these reports of total cases versus recovered, and there are certainly different ways to look at who has recovered.
And this, he's absolutely right. And this brings it back to what we discussed earlier about the rate is really what is going to make you determine whether you feel safe going out in your community. The number of people recovered is important, and it means we're getting better at treating this virus. But what you really should care about is not this absolute number of 114 people who have the virus in your county, but the rate of increase. So if it
Liberty,
jumps from 114 to 150.
Liberty, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Liberty Vittert is a professor of the practice of data science at Washington University in St. Louis. Coming up, we hear from the former Assistant Secretary of Health who served during the H1N1 flu pandemic about what he thinks the pandemic should look like right now. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.